Welcome to the NTNU International Taiwan Study Center podcast. We're here in Taipei again, and today I'm delighted to have Associate Professor Mukhaid Bayrak from the Department of Geography at this university at NTNU. So, welcome to the office here, our little podcast corner. It's great to have you. Do you think you could explain, just to start with, a little bit about what you've been up to recently, what things you've been researching and what occupies your time in NTNU at the moment?
Thank you for inviting me. My research mainly involves in how indigenous and local communities in Taiwan, but also Southeast Asia, cope with the adverse effects of climate change. I'm particularly interested in how it is affecting their livelihoods and how it's affecting their mobility patterns and how this is changing the landscapes that they have lived in as well. And I would say that's the core theme of my research, in which I specifically adopt a political ecology approach in trying to understand the adverse impacts of climate change, not only in the sense of the direct impacts, but about how this is actually more of a political issue. So often when I do research, it's really not clear what is an impact. If you talk, for example, with farmers, they would say, well, we are used to environmental change. I mean, that's the essence of our farming. So whether it's caused by climate change or not, that's what farmers say. We are used to dealing with changing weather patterns. We're used to changing climatic conditions. So in that essence, I often question, well, what is it that we can call impacts of climate change? And the reason why I adopt a political ecology approach is if you would label it as a climate change impact, then the next step would be to adapt. And who's deciding what's good adaptation? That's often decided in a top-down way. It's often decided by the government. So that the government would then say, this is how you adapt. And in the case if you are not able to adapt, then certainly becomes an individual responsibility because the government taught you how to adapt. And that's, I would say, the core focus of my research. Not so much in sense of how they can adapt, but also in the sense of what are the discourses on adaptation and how does that affect indigenous communities in Taiwan and elsewhere? Because what we often see is that a lot of communities are adapting to government adaptation program.
So practically speaking, then looking at adaptation to climate change, would it be in Taiwan, for example, specifically related to things like the increase of extreme weather events? Would that be a feature then of looking at how communities can adapt? And I guess that applies to both rural and urban communities.
Yes, I mean, obviously, some events can be directly attributed to climate change, right? So like what you mentioned, the increase in extreme weather events, but also changing weather variability. You often hear that dry seasons are particularly dry and wet seasons are particularly wet, particularly intense. We don't necessarily see an increase in typhoons, but we see an increase in intensity of typhoons. And what we have noticed, we have typhoons at unpredictable times, but it's also often the absence of typhoons. I mean, for several years, we had no typhoons in Taiwan, which also had a direct impact on our agricultural system, on our water availability, but also very subtle changes. For example, when we did research with the Dayan people, Dayan communities, they mentioned, well, because of the absence of typhoons, there are now more bees that are attacking us. Yeah, usually typhoons, they change the bee population in that sense. So there are direct impacts, there are more subtle impacts, but you cannot isolate those impacts from climate change or the climate crisis. We can better use the word climate crisis. Cannot isolate it from the broader political economy of how people are coping with other stresses and shocks. And that's what I'm trying to warn, is that we do not need to isolate, oh, here's climate change and here's the impact and this is what's happening. We need to adopt a more holistic view. And this is where the importance of political ecology comes in, that we ask ourselves, well, why are people isolating the effects? Why are we simply looking at climate change and its impacts? And why are we not incorporating other aspects? Well, it's easy. Climate change is a global phenomenon. And if we talk about who's responsible for this global phenomenon, it's the world community, right? So then when we talk about impacts, we do not necessarily look at it in terms of what political change we need to achieve. We just look at, okay, well, what adjustments can you make in order to stay in place? But if we acknowledge that climate change impacts are in fact deeply political, some people are more affected by its impacts than others. Some people are more resilient at the expense of others. And this is in its broadest sense. It's between regions, it's between communities, it's within communities, it's even within the households that impacts of climate change are what we say differential. If we do acknowledge that, then it also requires a political response. It's a response in which we structure certain aspects of society in a capitalist system that we are currently in. And that's what my research is mainly about.
I'm interested then to ask whether there are any examples of countries, or even perhaps here in Taiwan, where you've seen a more holistic approach. Have you ever seen, you know, policy being designed for climate adaption by taking into account more diverse communities in diverse locations and actually trying to tailor adaption strategies specifically to not be a one-size-fits-all, but actually let the politics be influenced by the ecology? And if so, do you see potential for that to be replicated, if it can be, more internationally?
Let's address your latter point. We should not seek for replication in the sense of one community does it well, so other communities just look at their model and take over in that sense. We need to ask farmers themselves. We need to ask what happened in your community that you are able to cope with negative effects, not only of climate change, but there's so many other drivers of environmental change. There's so many other drivers of economic crises, alcoholism, psychological issues. It's not just one thing that communities are dealing with. It's not like they wake up and say, okay, how are we going to cope with climate change? There are multiple stresses. At the same time, we should not approach them as victims either. Yeah, people have their agencies, people have their resilience, people go on with their daily life. So, you know, that victim or hero narrative, it's something that we need to go beyond that. When do we refer to certain events as a disaster? We refer to certain events as a disaster if it affects people. Once it affects people, there's undoubtedly a political component related to that. If it's not affecting people, we don't call it a disaster. We call it a phenomenon, right? So we should get rid of the idea that a natural disaster is something neutral. It's just something that happens to you and you just happen to be unlucky at the wrong place at the wrong time. The idea that a natural disaster is something neutral, so we just need neutral science to solve it. We just need to fix certain issues. It's not going to help and often will worsen certain impacts. So in terms of solutions, is listen to farmers, look at very specific coping mechanisms that they implemented, but also listen to their concerns and listen to the things that is really affecting them, like land tenure, like marketization, aging, like a community that is migrating out. And I guess the problem with policies is that they need to address one single issue, right? You can't have a policy that addresses everything. But we need to head to that direction, that we need to understand that impacts are interlinked. And we need, in that sense, a more holistic approach. And there are a lot of good grassroots movements, movements that, for example, focus on, let's say, organic agriculture, or movements that focus on recovering indigenous species of millet or of rice, or movements that would use agriculture as a way to culturally revitalize, to find ways of transferring indigenous knowledge, indigenous cosmologies to newer generations. And these movements are very inspiring. But as an academic myself, the only thing I could contribute is asking governments to be supportive, to provide a supportive environment, and trying to combat the real deep-rooted inequalities that are here, not only in Taiwan, but in many other parts of the world.
You talk about the deep-rooted inequality, and that really is what often causes a natural disaster to be a disaster for some communities more than others, isn't it? I know in Taiwan, Typhoon Morakot in 2009 affected indigenous communities so badly because they were living on really dangerous land. And like you say, then you get this hero victim narrative of these people been hit by a neutral natural disaster and need to be saved by the heroes. But actually, unless that deep inequality gets addressed, it's going to happen again when the next so-called neutral natural disaster comes along. So that really, I guess, adds a lot of importance and urgency to the political ecology side of what you're researching and what you're doing. Have you seen any kind of positive movement in Taiwan over the years that you've been doing research in terms of government understanding a little bit more about this deep-rooted inequality and trying to address some of those deeper issues? I mean, this can apply to almost any country in the world, I think.
Top-down solutions still very much dominate current policies in Taiwan as well as elsewhere. And of course, top-down is not always bad. But in that sense, I cannot come up with a clear case that I said, well, that's really inspiring. Some positive movements that we see in Taiwan is that we are a democratic society. So there's now more and more voices of indigenous people that can express discontents, that can offer alternatives, modes of development, alternatives, ways of how we cope with ecosystems, as well as supposedly neutral disasters in that sense. There are more and more stories about indigenous claims to land. And I think there's where the solution is, that people can claim the land. So what makes people indigenous is often their relationship with lands. They have a very holistic relationship with their lands. So if we allow them to have rights to their lands, not just in, oh, this is indigenous territories, but they're actually able to make decisions based on their lands. But again, we should not over-romanticize it. For example, different communities lay different claims on the same lands. And how do we define a community? Like, we often assume that the community is this homogeneous entity that all looks towards the same direction. That's not the case either. There are different individuals within communities with different interests. There are gendered components in which men and women have different conceptions of human-environment relationships. So there are a lot of conflicts, not just between the state and the indigenous community, but there are conflicts between communities, intra-communities, but also within households in that sense. So it would be very difficult to say, oh, this is a very successful movement and this is something we need to pursue. But to give an example, we did research in Nanao Township and we talked to young indigenous farmers that were trying to revitalize their indigenous species. Yeah, so they would say, oh, we used to have 7 to 8 types of millet and now we only know 1 or 2. So we're trying to figure out how we can take back that particular knowledge. That will not necessarily make them more resilient to climate change. It's not like they're coming with a piece of millet that is climate resilient, but it does contribute to a cultural revitalization. And hopefully with the cultural revitalization, there are more and more voices to inquire within the community to say, well, what is it that we call indigenous knowledge? What is it that we have? What can we learn from our elders? And again, it's not just something you have. It's also something you learn. It's something you live. It's something you perceive. It's something. And I can't say, well, this is a grassroots solution that I think, okay, that is going to be very inspiring. And sometimes I'm quite pessimistic in that sense to say, well, with an increase in democratic voices, we're not necessarily changing our fundamental relationship with indigenous communities, or we are not necessarily making certain policy changes that gives real autonomy to indigenous communities, give real power to indigenous communities. I'm sure you know about the case of the indigenous Bunun hunter that got prosecuted. And you know that the court cases went on and on and on. And then in the end, he got, I think it was Tsai Ing-wen, exonerated him. Yes. But the system itself did not change. It was an individual case. And after years and years of protest, of court cases, of media discourses, he got exonerated. And I have a very double feeling about it. On one hand, I'm like, okay, at least the government is sensitive enough to say, well, you know, let the guy go. He just shoot some goats to feed his mother that just wanted to taste some bushmeat. But he has been criticized by his own community members as well. So again, it's not a hero victim narrative, but in the end, nothing changed institutionally. And that takes a much longer process. That takes a much more dialogue and reforms. And I think as a foreigner, I'm not in the right position to say, how are we going to push that forward? But there are a lot of Taiwanese and indigenous scholars and researchers that are pushing into that, especially those that focus on land reforms, indigenous territories and their relationship with land. But I think there is really where the solution should be, restore people's relationship with land by giving them real autonomy. And I'm not sure if in this current political climate, not only in Taiwan, but just the way how governments functions, the way how states functions, where there's room for that.
Yeah, that's interesting. And I guess there's examples all around the world of the same issue of governments, whether it's in Canada or Australia or USA or, you know, many more places where there's indigenous communities who have been, I guess, essentially robbed of their land, who want their rights back for the land. And all the different governmental structures in these places, whether they're democratic or not, seem to be struggling to come up with the policies that actually give autonomy back to the people who it's their land originally. Anyway, but then again, like you say, for us living in a city and looking on, it's easy to say, isn't it? When you're living there and when these decisions really affect you, then it's a lot more complex. Just bringing it back, I'm interested in the young farmers in Nanao that you talked about who were trying to bring back some indigenous species of millet. Do you know what was the motivation behind that? Why were they bothering? Because like you mentioned, the majority of indigenous people in Taiwan live in cities anyway. So in this case, what was it that inspired these young folks to stay or return to their community and try and revitalize the kind of the agricultural life of it?
Good question. And I mean, of course, we asked, right? And it's related to cultural revival and sense of identity and fearing that this very valuable knowledge would get lost.
Is that a wider trend that you've seen in other places as well, in other communities, and maybe even not just limiting this to indigenous Taiwanese, but also other Han Taiwanese communities? Is there a trend of people going back from an urban life to try and revitalize something of a rural life?
Yeah, so we have to be careful with making general observations. I mean, when people move back, very often they move back to take care of their parents, to take care of the elderly, right? So it's hard to say like, oh, we see a movement of people going back and trying to revitalize the agricultural system. I don't think that would be a correct observation that I could make. So when you ask me like what motivated these young farmers, and with young, I mean farmers that were 40, 50, that's what I mean, you know, what motivated them to go back? Well, you know, they would tell you cultural revitalization and so on. But it's hard to say, you know, what the deep motivations are. I think instead of trying to find general trends, we can just look at certain examples that we say, hey, this is an interesting example, and really trying to understand what's going on particularly there. At the same time, we also have to realize if you live in cities, as even as an indigenous person yourself, you're also starting to over-romanticize your own community. Right? You might look at urban life and you might be fed up. It could be that some people feel like that they have lost something and they're going back to find what they lost. And they're probably not going to find that because what they felt they lost is living inside their mind in that sense. But what's hopeful to say is that people do start to realize the importance of different crop species as a form of relationship with lands. And the same thing with, for example, lands. Like when we say give back lands, in government terms, it means, oh, give someone land tenure. And once you have land tenure, you have to start paying tax. And you have to abide to government rules and with the fear of you losing your land if you do not follow what governments do. So it's not simply about the government saying, hey, this is the land, you get it back. It's also thinking about, well, the institutional changes that requires. Changes in the sense of how do you deal with land conflicts between communities? If two communities lay claims on particular land. But it's also, we have to get rid of the idea that indigenous communities have the same land tenure system as that we have, that you either have private land or public lands. Land tenure systems can be temporal, they can be seasonal. And we should not assume that before the Taiwanese states or the Republic of China had complete control over Taiwan, that indigenous people had no land conflicts or that they were all living in peace and harmony with one another. So I would say it's much more complicated than that. But again, we are dealing with a changing political economy. We could argue like, well, if you would go back to become a rice farmer, let's say, you know, we import all rice from Vietnam and from Thailand. So what purpose does it make to grow rice? What I saw in my current research in, for example, western coast of Taiwan with non-indigenous communities was the encroachment of solar panels. and the way how people talked about solar panels was in the same vein as how they would talk about other natural disasters. There's a lot of research done also in Taiwan to say, okay, this is a local community. How do they cope with climate change? Okay, they plant more drought resilient rice, or they diversify their livelihoods. Maybe they do ecotourism. Yeah, you have a lot of examples of indigenous communities doing ecotourism and say, okay, ecotourism might be the way. But the way how I see this kind of studies is a kind of justification of why people should be allowed to stay. So if you can stay in a rural area and you can successfully engage in the market economy, you should be able to stay. So you have a successful ecotourism project, you should be able to stay. You have found a certain niche in agriculture, like organic farming or other kinds of farming, you should be allowed to stay. But for anyone else that cannot be a successful entrepreneur, perhaps you would like to join the masses and move to urban areas because you can no longer be economically viable in the area that you are. And I think we should get rid of that idea that people need to find a justification that they should stay, especially with indigenous communities. We should not ask ourselves, should they stay or should they go? We should ask ourselves the question, what relationship do they have with land and what do they want with land? And they might leave the community and they might leave the village, but they do not necessarily leave the community in that sense.
There's so many layers of complexity there that I think it's really important to wrestle with that, even when we don't have the answers, because oversimplifying things is the easy way. And yet that just brings up so many other problems. So finally, I'd just like to bring this into the context of the Taiwan studies field. So the research that you've been carrying out in Taiwan over these years, how would you see that contributing in one sense to the Taiwan studies field, but then having relevance beyond?
Of course, in Taiwan, we have a very rich field on indigenous knowledge, indigenous science. There's so many inspiring scholars that do great research. But I also do feel like that a lot of this research that does not get translated internationally. In that sense, it's like we know very little about the research that's being done in Taiwan. That's partly because the politics of academia, that Taiwan in that sense is just a small country and people are just not interested to know what's happening in Taiwan. I mean, often when I submit a paper on Taiwan, I always get the remark from reviewers that it's not international enough. But if the research was done in the US or anywhere else, then that would already be considered international. So that's partly the politics of academic writing and academic publishing. But as a community within Taiwan, we also have to be critical of ourselves, yeah, that we are not too much inward looking, that we do not try to find exceptionalism, that, oh, this is so exceptional in Taiwan, this is that there's no way for international scholars to find any relevance in that. We also have to be very careful with gatekeeping, that we say, hey, this is my field of knowledge and I will make it very difficult for outsiders to join in, right? And that's not just only Taiwan studies, that's in any field of science, that there are gatekeepers that you have to deal with. So I would say that in terms of Taiwan studies, we have to understand that in one hand, Taiwan is not exceptional in the sense of a lot of issues related to indigenous communities, indigenous knowledge, climate change are issues that we see in so many other communities all around the world. So we need to facilitate more international cross-cultural communication. I mean, I visited a symposium in Pingtung, in a Rukai township. And what I found very fascinating is that a lot of these young Rukai people and Paiwan people, they got fellowships in, for example, Hawaii or Guam, and they start developing an Austronesian identity, which I find very fascinating. They have this renewed identity based on Austronesianness. And that's perhaps a way forward to say, okay, well, indigenous Taiwanese, they are part of the Austronesian family. So what kind of cross-cultural research can we do? At the same time, we also have to realize that, of course, we are exceptional in the sense of a lot of research that we do in indigenous knowledge, and it's very context-bounded, right? It's very contextualized. If you do not understand the context, we are not able to understand how communities adapt to climate change and so on. So we need to continue stimulating domestic scholarship. We need to stimulate, more research done by indigenous researchers themselves. we need to try to cultivate a new generation of indigenous researchers that with one feet they are in international academia, and with other feet they are with their communities doing the kind of research. And as a foreigner or as an outsider, the thing that I should be doing is to facilitate this development. So it's not my responsibility, or it's not my task to say, okay, I'm going to do research with the community and I bring the findings to the rest of the world and look at me. But to say, okay, well, how can we cultivate young talents, new talents, that on one hand know the academics side of it, they know the political academic side of it, they know how to talk to an international academic community, but on the other hand, also stay rooted in the communities where you do your research. And I would say research, especially when we do research about this topic, it's not only about generating knowledge that gets into academic journals no one reads, but also trying to engage more in activism, in finding solidarity movements, not only within Taiwan, but also outside of Taiwan. Also trying to engage with Taiwan studies in Europe or in the US, and trying to put more indigenous scholarship into this very rich field of Taiwan studies. And I very much support the idea of Taiwan studies, but we need to consider that Taiwan studies is more like an umbrella term of different topics that have been done. But I do think there are a lot of opportunities to move this field of Taiwan studies forward by trying to convince outsiders that Taiwan is more than just in relation to China. I find this topic very boring. Taiwan in relation to China. I was like, okay, well, that's just one part of Taiwan studies. And if you do research into that, good for you. Continue to do that. But I hope it would not define Taiwan studies as it is. And at the same time, we should be less insular, that we say, okay, Taiwan is not just an exception, you know, like we're not exceptional. So if you do research about indigenous communities in Taiwan, engage more with works on indigenous communities elsewhere. Even better, try to find ways to connect communities with one another so you can have intra-community learning. So the grassroots movements that you talked about, the good solutions that you talked about, would come from this kind of dialogues with one another. Like, what's the whole purpose of doing this research if it just gets published into an article and no one reads it? So what I often tell students is to be very humble when you do research with indigenous communities or local communities. They're giving you their time. They're giving you their knowledge. And the only one that is benefiting from it is you yourself, because you get a degree based on people's information. People themselves don't get anything from it. I mean, we got some Family Mart vouchers, but people do not give you their time for any of that. People give you their time because they do hope that you have a positive impact. And I do think that a lot of indigenous and local communities are kind of disillusioned by the massive academics that enter their communities, gather data, and then they leave the community again and publish the findings and they move on. And I'm guilty of that myself as well. So as academics, and yeah, again, we need institutional change. Yeah, as academics, we are evaluated based on the papers we publish. KPI, right? KPI is something we hear every day. An essential part of KPI is social engagement, how we can reach. And it's not just doing a podcast. A podcast is it's lazy. You can just go, I just went to your office and I talk into this microphone and then I leave again. How can we make social outreach more meaningful? And I really think that we need to cultivate a new generation of indigenous researchers that can talk the academic language, but at the same time also do not lose their connection to their community, even if they have moved to Taipei or somewhere else in that sense.
Wow, thank you so much. That's a really important call to action there, to make sure that actually research isn't for research's sake. It's for change's sake, for positive change. Yeah, thank you so much. Yeah, it's been a pleasure to be engaging with these issues and in conversation with you. So thank you very much, Mukha. And I look forward to speaking again soon.
Thank you, Justin.
So that was Professor Mukahid Bairak from the Department of Geography at NTNU. Thanks for listening. I'm looking forward to connecting again on our next episode. And if you're interested, don't forget that you can sign up for our International Taiwan Study Center newsletter from the show notes. See you next time, guys. Goodbye.